This episode of Radioactive Magazine explores how net neutrality is necessary to counter mainstream media's overreaching control of public policy. We will focus especially on two important issues, our political economy and the nation's nuclear contamination problem. For both issues, we will briefly reflect on how the media distort the informed debate. In our first segment, we will elaborate on one model of political economy, modern monetary theory, also known by its initials MMT. In particular, we will examine why MMT economists recommend a job guarantee. Then we will see why mainstream media have blocked discussion of such a policy and how net neutrality helps open the discussion. Radioactive host Spencer Graves begins by tracing the decades-long growth in income inequality. He then explains how a job guarantee can produce faster, more stable, and more broadly shared economic growth, and why the FCC's attack on net neutrality limits serious consideration of MMT. The leading research center on MMT is the Economics Department at the University of Missouri at Kansas City. They have for years hosted international conferences about research into MMT and related areas. The last one ran September 21-24. Stephanie Kelton, formerly a professor of economics at UMKC and chief economist for the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign, is a leading MMT expert. Dr. Kelton contends that faster, more stable, and more broadly shared economic growth can be achieved through a job guarantee in the U.S. or in any other country with its own currency. In this episode, we will explain why a job guarantee actually does produce better economic growth and why MMT provides a better explanation of the behavior of things like gross domestic product, unemployment, inflation, and capacity utilization during the Great Depression and the Great Recession, and at other times. In income inequality, to understand why MMT advocates why MMT advocates for a job guarantee, we first review what the data show us about income inequality. Government economic data reveals a discrepancy in the growth of average income versus the growth in median income. The average is calculated by summing up all the economic activity in the country and dividing by the population. The median family income is the middle value, so half of the families are below the median and half are above. We can get data on this from a standard U.S. Census report on median income distribution that starts with 1947. Between 47 and 2007, the average income grew at very roughly 2% per year. The median family income also grew at roughly that rate from 1947 until around 1970. Between 1970 and 2010, the average continued to grow at roughly 1.8% per year, while the median increased at only about 0.5% per year. As a result, the average doubled while the median increased by only about 23%. The gap between what the median family actually takes home today and what they would if the gains had been broadly shared is roughly $40,000 a year. If we round that down to $36,500, that's $100 a day. Therefore, moreover, I claim that modern monetary theory suggests that this estimate of $100 per day is actually quite conservative. So, if the median stagnated while the average increased, that means that the incomes of people making more than the median increased faster than the average. It turns out that only the top 0.5% of the U.S. income distribution grew faster than the average. And the top 0.01% increased at a rate that's roughly double that of the average since 1970. In other words, this is not a story of the 99% versus the 1%. This is a story of the 99.5% versus the top 0.5%. So why did the median grow so slowly after 1970 when it had grown at the same rate as the average before? Different experts would answer that question differently, but I see two major contributors. First, the power of organized labor began to decline in the 1970s, which made it harder for working people to bargain for better wages, etc. Second, the ultra-wealthy followed the advice of Lewis Powell in the then-secret Powell Memorandum. Powell told them to build a network of right-wing think tanks to produce scientific-looking reports providing a plausible rationale for giving more money to the wealthy, and buy up the mainstream commercial media and suppress coverage of the cries for better wages, working conditions, environmental protection, and product safety. Powell and his half-percent elites felt that Ralph Nader and the consumer and environmental movements of that day were out of control and leading the country down a slippery slope to socialism. That had to be resisted at all costs. Part of that project involved firing nearly all the investigative journalists from commercial television. A few popular programs like 60 Minutes were spared. Why investigative journalists? Because investigative journalists are likely to find questionable favors that major corporations get from government. That threatens the people who control major advertising budgets that pay for television production and broadcasts, and that's no business makes money by biting the hands that feed them. You can libel and slander poor people with impunity, but if you say something that offends a major advertiser, you're in trouble. So how does this relate to net neutrality? Net neutrality is the principle that all traffic on the internet should be treated equally, regardless of the source or the type of data. That means that anyone with an internet connection can compete in the marketplace of ideas based solely on the quality of their presentation. Everyone officially agrees with net neutrality, that principle. However, major internet access providers want to block, throttle, alter, and redirect users' requests for information from the internet so corporations that provide access can make money selling users' data and extorting higher fees to deliver content at the high speeds that everyone now expects. Violations of net neutrality like these since 2007 produced 8 years of increasing activism that drove the U.S. Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, to adopt several reforms that were blocked in the courts. Finally, early in 2015, the FCC adopted a Title II order that allowed the FCC to enforce net neutrality, and it was confirmed by the courts. Under the Trump administration, the FCC is attempting to overturn this 2015 Title II order. They are doing this with a notice of proposed rulemaking with the Orwellian title of Restoring Internet Freedom. This NPRM would officially transfer enforcement of net neutrality to the Federal Trade Commission and to the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice. Opponents of the proposed rule change insist that the transfer would make enforcement practically impossible. And without enforcement, major internet access providers like Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, and Spectrum, formerly Chartered and Time Warner Cable, stand to make billions by blocking, throttling, altering, including stripping encryption, and redirecting users' requests for information from the internet to extort higher fees for delivering content at the high speeds that everyone has come to expect. Under a 1946 law, the FCC must publish their proposed rulemaking and give the public a period of time to comment on the proposed changes. This requires agencies of the federal government to issue two deadlines for comments and then for replies to other people's comments. The initial comment period ended July 17. The reply comment deadline was August 30th. Almost 22 million public comments were filed by the August 30 deadline. I was involved in filing comments for both the Friends of Community Media and for EffectiveDefense.org for both the July 17 and August 30 deadlines. I also discussed this in episodes of Radioactive Magazine broadcast on July 25th and August 22nd. Meanwhile, the mainstream media have published very little about the FCC's proposed attack on net neutrality. Why? Because the mainstream media do not want competition for the bottom 99.5%. Moreover, the ultra-wealthy who control advertising budgets do not want their messages contested on an open internet by those with fewer resources. To the extent that the mainstream media controls the message, they also control public policy, and their favored elites reap greater wealth. So what can the bottom 99.5% do about this? A number of organizations concerned about this notice of proposed rulemaking have formed a coalition called BattleForTheNet.com. These organizations are mobilizing people to contact their representatives in the U.S. House and Senate to convince them to oppose the FCC's proposed rule change. If enough members of Congress support enforceable net neutrality, we will keep it regardless of what the FCC does. Why does this matter? Whatever substantive issue you might be working on for reform or concerned about, net neutrality is fundamental for your efforts. Progress on every substantive issue I can think of is currently blocked because every proposed countermeasure for reform threatens someone with substantive control over the media. That's the current status. If you do not want Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, and Spectrum blocking, throttling, altering, or redirecting your requests for information from the internet as they have and as they did prior to the Title II order in 2015, you are encouraged to educate yourself on this issue, including visiting battleforthenet.com. There is also a summary of these issues in the Wikiversity article on net neutrality and restoring internet freedom. As part of this effort, I joined perhaps a dozen others in a meeting August 31st with a person working in Representative Kevin Yoder's office in Overland Park, and I exchanged emails with Representative Yoder and Kansas Senators Moran and Roberts, and I believe other people are working to arrange similar, more similar meetings, again, through battleforthenet.com. All three of Representative Yoder and Senators Moran and Roberts declared their support for the FCC's proposed rule change, a change that would allow, as I said, corporations to block, throttle, alter, and redirect your request for information from the internet. Permit me to spell this out a little bit more clearly. If your internet access provider runs software that can redirect your requests for information from the internet, some hacker might use those capabilities of your internet access provider software to redirect your connection to your bank's website through the hacker's mirror. While you are managing your finances, they are capturing your keystrokes without you noticing anything unusual. There is a very small chance that this could happen to you today with even with net neutrality, but it would be substantially more likely if the internet access providers are secretly redirecting your traffic for other purposes, as some of them did prior to the 2015 Title II order allowed and authorized the FCC to enforce rules against it. Now let's look at the connection between net neutrality and modern monetary theory. As mentioned above, UMKC professor Stephanie Kelton says that the U.S. or any other country with its own currency could have faster, more stable, and more broadly shared economic growth with the job guarantee. This better, more broadly shared economic growth would make everyone better off in an absolute sense. Everyone would, on average, live longer and have more control over their lives. On the other hand, broadly shared economic growth might reduce the relative privileges of the top one half of 1%. They are threatened by MMT and by a job guarantee. As a result, MMT gets relatively little coverage in the mainstream media. A job guarantee sounds like pie in the sky, just another utopian fantasy that could not possibly work. So let me explain how it would work and why MMT experts seem to have models that provide better explanation for the available macroeconomic data than more traditional economists. First, a key thing to note is that most organizations are not operating at full capacity, but well below that. Since 1967, the United States Federal Reserve Board has asked manufacturers about the maximum level of production they could reasonably attain. The resulting estimates of capacity utilization have ranged between 66 and 89%. In other words, even at the peak of 89% capacity, the nation as a whole could produce 10 or 11% more goods and services without investing in new plants and equipment. To see that, note that the average cost per unit nearly always declines as more units are produced and sold. With a job guarantee, consumers could obtain and spend more money as capacity utilization increased to 99%, producers' gross profits would almost always increase. This means, moreover, that this increased production could be accomplished without inflation. Profit margins might not increase for producers who are not currently paying a living wage and might be forced to pay workers more to compete with the job guarantee. However, we should not use that as an excuse to avoid promoting the general welfare. This sounds great, but how would we pay for it? Easy. Just print the money or issue the comparable electronic funds transfer from the federal government. That sounds crazy. Wouldn't the federal budget deficit go through the roof? Well, yes, but why should we care about that? MMT economists advise us to ignore the federal budget deficit. Yes, MMT recognizes that if demand exceeds 100% of inflation, it could drive up inflation. That has happened in wartime in U.S. history. However, it did not happen during World War II, even when the national debt exceeded 100% of GDP with no inflation, or with essentially no inflation. Why? Because the Roosevelt administration, the federal government at that time, was aware of this risk and took appropriate measures to avoid it. The point here is that we can increase the deficit without inflation. However, one aspect of the proposal for a job guarantee is almost certain. It will immediately generate a massive propaganda campaign in the mainstream media to defend established elites and destroy the careers of politicians who dare to support MMT and a job guarantee. This massive propaganda offensive appears to be the most serious risk the nation would likely encounter from a job guarantee. This is an example of a principle I mentioned earlier. Progress on every issue, in this case promoting the general welfare among the nation's poor and middle class, is blocked because a job guarantee threatens the social status of established elites. When a critical mass of the electorate comes to understand this, we will have, as Kelton said, faster, more stable, and more broadly shared economic growth. Everyone, including the elites, will on average live longer, more healthy lives, and have more control over how they spend their time, though the wealthy may not have as many personal servants, butlers, and maids. Let me explain how this would stabilize the economy. When one person loses a job, he or she generally spends less. If more people are laid off than are hired, the reduction in aggregate demand forces other companies to reduce their workforces. Without a job guarantee, that effect cascades through the economy, causing other companies to reduce their workforces. A job guarantee reduces that ripple effect because people who lose their job can readily find another. If they were previously making the same amount of money as offered by the guaranteed job, there would be no reduction in aggregate demand, and the initial business downturn is less likely to snowball through the rest of the economy. What about reducing income inequality? A job guarantee means that employees at or below a living wage always have an option. This makes it easier for them to bargain individually or collectively for better wages and working conditions. So-called job creators may not benefit except by reducing the risk of their investments because of the stabilization of the economy. However, do we really need to reward so handsomely the so-called job creators who create so few jobs? As noted above, the benefits of productivity growth were broadly shared at least from 1947, the start of the U.S. Census data commonly used for this kind of thing, until organized labor started losing strength around 1970. Since Ronald Reagan became president in 1981, the economies of the U.S. and much of the rest of the world have been driven in part by supply-side economics, also called trickle-down economics. The point here is that available data clearly indicate that the designated job creators have not created enough jobs, and the benefits of productivity growth trickle down to the poor and the middle class before supply side and trickle down became part of the official dogma. But not since. Without adequate demand, the designated job creators have not created enough jobs, and the poor and the middle class have fallen behind, have not gotten their fair share of the benefits of productivity improvements. MMT also provides a better explanation for the increase in inequality and for inflation and any other macroeconomic numbers I've seen than the traditional economic theory that have long been used to drive the U.S. and international economies. A final word about the perceived threat of inflation. Inflation occurs in two scenarios. Number one, inflation can occur when production is driven above capacity, as has happened in times of war. But as I said before, it did not happen during World War II, when the Roosevelt administration knew that inflation could be a problem and took effective steps to avoid it. Number two, inflation can also occur when a cartel or a company that dominates a market increases prices because they can. A major example of this is the OPEC price increases of the 1970s. MMT experts claim that these OPEC price increases were defeated after President Carter deregulated natural gas. Natural gas prices fell, consumption increased, the consumption of crude oil declined, and OPEC was no longer able to sustain their artificially high prices. The conclusion from this is that the bottom 99.5% of the U.S. and world's population need to do what Lewis Powell secretly told the wealthy in 1971. Get control of the media, do more fact-checking, and aggressively defend your interests.
I'm Jamie Jackson. I'm with the Coalition Against Contamination Bannister Cover-Up. I'm here talking today with Barbara Youngblood, and she's going to tell us a story about her family and her father who worked at the Bannister complex and a little bit about what that means for her. So Barbara, if you want to just talk to us a little bit about your dad.
Yes, thank you for having me. My dad worked for the Bannister complex from 1977 to 2003. And during that time, he was a diligent worker. He worked constantly. Every day he was going to work. Daddy went to work and came home and collected a paycheck. We didn't know what he did. He wasn't allowed to talk to us about what he did. All we knew is he went to work. I lost my dad August 14th of this year, and it hurts because I think that his life was shortened. We don't know really what Dad died of specifically. All we know is that the doctors told us that he had scarring of the lungs, he had cancer markers near his stomach and colon, he had cirrhosis of the liver. My dad never smoked a day in his life. He never drank a drop of alcohol ever. I know that's hard for some people to believe, but I know it's true. He was constantly out of breath. The reason I'm here is to get his story out. The only reason I found out about the coalition was through a friend of Dad's that worked with him and said, you need to contact Maurice Copeland and tell him your story because they need to know this. And so I called Maurice and talk to him. But had this friend not told me about this, I would have never in my life known what was going on over at Bannister, what dangerous chemicals my dad was affiliated with, because he never talked about it. My mom did not know what he did. We did not know what he did. He said, we're not allowed to discuss it.
And how long did he work out there at the Bannister Complex?
26 years.
So, as you probably know, there's tens of thousands of people in the Kansas City area who either worked out there or are family members of people who worked out there. And all of those workers were exposed to toxins, both radioactive toxins and other chemical toxins that cause diseases. So that in 2001, President Clinton signed a bill that promised compensation for workers who contract certain diseases after they have worked at the Bannister Federal Complex. The Coalition Against Contamination formed because the Department of Labor over the last 17 years has been blocking people from getting compensation, and because the media has not been covering the existence of that law, the danger that came from working at the Bannister Complex, and what families can do about it. So let me ask you, you just heard about this from a friend of your dad's.
Yes.
After he died.
Yes, after he died, he called me and said you needed to get a hold of them. I think based on the information that we were given from the doctors about the cirrhosis of the liver and the scarring of the lungs and the cancer markers, he thought that I needed to get in touch with Maurice, but I did not hear about this from anyone else.
Possibly more will begin to come out because recently a whistleblower with the Department of Labor came forward to say that officials in the Department of Labor who handles these claims were deliberately thwarting workers from realizing the compensation that they were due. And so now there's going to be an investigation in Congress, both in the House and in the Senate, to look into the misdeeds of the officials in the Department of Labor. But let's look at what your story is, because your dad didn't know to file a complaint.
No.
Or a claim. And you just found out about it almost by accident.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have a whole procedure to go through.
Yes.
To try and reconstruct your dad's years at the Bannister Complex. Mm-hmm. And how he might have been exposed when he didn't feel free to even talk about it with his family.
Correct. I have already started, through Maurice's help, filing a claim with the Department of Labor, and I had an interview with them, a phone interview with them on the 15th of September. They sent me a packet of that, a transcript of that interview to go over. Some of the things I have to correct, but along with that packet, now I have got to go and get all of Dad's medical records to prove that these things went on. And that's a task in itself. So it's not an easy task to go through.
I'm sure it's not.
Just from my dad being in the hospital from May 20th till July 27th, I have two boxes that are probably a foot tall. So probably 24 inches of papers,
right.
Just medical records,
right.
Just from that one incident. So,
right.
And they need all that sent to them.
Right.
So the process has begun, but it's time consuming and we're getting it
right.
Done.
Well, I wish you luck on that, and I know you're going to come for our town hall. We're having a town hall at the Southeast Community Center from 10 to noon. On October 28th, that's Halloween weekend, but we're hoping that people can come from 10 to noon. And we'll be giving information about the process for filing a claim. We'll be hearing from other people who have filed claims. There will be lawyers and politicians there to sit on a panel and answer questions about the process. So it'll be an informational meeting, and we're hoping that anyone listening to this who is either affected directly or who has family members or friends who are affected by their working at the Bannister Complex will come to that town hall meeting. The media has not been covering this, and if you want, you could write a little short note to the Kansas City Star and ask them to cover the issue, because otherwise many people who need to know don't know.
If you have a family member that has deceased, fight for them, because they're not here to fight anymore. And it's important not only for their memory, but for those that are still here and in the surrounding area that are affected by it. So get the word out.
No, I'm glad you brought that up, because it isn't just workers who once did work at the Bannister Federal Complex, but also environmental threats that are still with us and will be occurring as a result of the Bannister Kansas City plant. So yeah. It's important that all of us in Kansas City understand the threat that this poses to us and try to take appropriate action. Well, thank you so much, Barbara, for being with us today, and we wish you the best of luck with your claim.
Thank you for having me.